Hello and welcome to another episode of And the Winner Is, where we take a stroll back at all, and look at all the best picture winners of the Oscar. This time around, we're looking at the 1929 stroke 30 winner, All Quiet on the Western Front. Because, of course, we're still in that period when we were having sort of doubled up sort of Oscars while it was finding its feet. Joining me as always is Paul. All right, mate?
Yep, not too bad. Not too bad. Yep. We're doing this a little bit differently. We recorded the previous episode a week ago.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit strange. Normally we record these back to back. So right. It's like I'm not hosting tonight, which is quite nice.
Yeah. So it takes a bit of a minute to sort of work out where we are as well.
Yeah.
It can't be worse than me thinking it was one I was going to do when I wasn't on the other podcast. this seems to be one that's been waiting to get ranked to break it, one of the earliest ones, and it's just
And especially with the fact that they did a remake not that long ago.
Yes.
It was kind of one that was on our radar that just hadn't come up.
Yes.
And obviously being an early one as well, it's quite a well known one.
Yeah. Well, we'll probably talk about the remake at some point towards the end, actually. So I've got some thoughts on that. So this was released in April 21st, 1930 in the US. Interestingly, originally had a running time of 152 minutes, and the restored version is 133. Usually find restored versions are longer.
Yeah. Yeah, obviously there must have been some footage that wasn't good enough.
As I was jumping into one or two bits and pieces, first off, on the budget for this was $1.2 million. Any thought on a worldwide rental?
I would imagine it probably maybe 20 million.
No, apparently it's 3 million.
Blimey, it must have been one of those ones where it hasn't got a proper box office.
Yeah, and he was also, I'll throw it in as an extra fact, of course, he was banned in Germany, of course, as well at one point.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that when we talk about the film.
Yeah, so that's kind of half a fact I just thrown in at the start for you there. The other thing I was going to mention, what he was up against that year, it was the third Academy Awards, and he was up against, get myself in the right place, it was up against The Big House, Disraeli, The Divorcee, and The Love Parade, none of which I've seen, or even I've only heard of Disraeli.
So, yeah, I think I've heard of The Divorcee.
Yeah.
I'm sure that must have had like an early Hollywood scarlet in it, I'm sure.
It's an MGM film.
There you go. There's your answer.
Norma Shearer is the divorcee.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, MGM's kind of on the radar a bit. So we do get them come up quite a bit. As always, we'll just throw in a couple of little facts and I get myself having a technical issue.
You can see we do prep. We do some prep. It just sometimes it doesn't work.
No, and we have fat fingers while I do anyway. as I was saying, we'll probably discuss it a bit more, but the film was initially banned in Germany by the Nazi Minister of the Interior, Wilhelm Frick, on the grounds it represented Germans as cowards. Ironically, in Poland, that country censorship board described the film as being pro-German, so it was not well received either.
No.
The director, Lewis Milestone, deliberately made the film without any music, so to take away from the series of the subject. And you know, I didn't even notice at the time there wasn't any music.
No, I didn't either. So no, it's very, very interesting.
Decision, really.
Yeah, exactly.
But apparently, some theatres at the time added music of their own in because they weren't used to having any scores on the back. And I think that didn't get out very well. Talking about box office again and the budget, because it was made for a considerable sum of $1.25 million at the time, and production began only a few months after the 1929 stock market crash, which kind of highlights the perspective of the gamble Universal took in making it.
Yeah.
Paid off with the best picture for them. I believe their first best picture as well.
Yep. Yeah, I would imagine so. I'm just trying to think. Yes, it was. Do you know why I had to think? Because at Universal Studios Hollywood, obviously I've been going to Universal Studios Hollywood for for about 17 years on and off. And I
Wow.
had to think that when you go on the Studio Tram tour, it begins, they have posters, and it begun with just being their Oscar winners. And then it became their biggest films of that year. And All Quiet on the Western Front is the first one.
Ah, cool.
And that's why I was having to think, I was, because I watched it the other day because they're celebrating the 60th anniversary of
Yeah.
the Tram Tour in its current guise. And I watched it the other day and I was like, I'm trying to think which posters were where, and I'm sure it is. I'm sure it is All Quiet on the Western Front is the first poster.
Oh, that's cool. It's quite cool that they sort of embrace their history at Universal, you
Yeah,
know, and
very much so. And obviously some of those films that have been their biggest hits of the year are kind of weird ones that you may not think of as being, like, one year they've got American Pie up because that was their biggest year, biggest film of the year, which you wouldn't think. I know it's a massive
No.
cult thing, and we've watched it for our other podcast, but it's not one you'd think of being their biggest film of the year, but it's quite interesting to see it.
Yeah, so a couple of other facts. Quite a sad one. Lewis Wallheim earned some of the best notices of his career playing Cat, and he was set to star in Lewis Marsden's next film, The Front Page, in 1931, but apparently he unexpectedly died of stomach cancer in 31.
Oh.
So as a career that was kind of cut off
Yeah.
before he even got anywhere. And the other one I pulled out was that the title apparently comes from German newspaper articles to do with translation. Articles would rave about glorious fixtures on the Eastern Front, but dismiss the horrors playing out on the Western Front in a nothing to see here folks manner by the simple phrase, nothing new in the West, hence All Quiet on the Western Front. I thought that was quite an interesting title.
Yeah.
And the final part of one I was going to throw out, apparently there were about 2,000 extras used in the film, many of them Germans who were living in the US after World War One. And now we'll talk about that in a minute, but that they're all there on the screen, basically. There's extras.
Yeah, very much so.
So I suppose at that point, I should just say that I thought I watched this on Amazon Prime.
Yep.
I rented it, and of course, because it being so old, it's in the old 4:3 Academy ratio, which always takes a bit of adjusting to these days on a
Yeah.
widescreen 4K TV. So I
Yeah,
think, oh.
very much so. And I did the same, and it's really interesting because you can definitely see where it's been remastered at times as well. There's some scenes that look like they've done nothing to them for the most part. And then there's some, especially when it's close-ups, that the work that they've done on it to remaster it is incredible.
Clean it up. And there's still a nice element of grain as well from an old film that you wouldn't
Yeah.
want. It doesn't look waxy like they played with it too
No.
much. So, right, I suppose at that point we'll jump in and get a few thoughts on the film. And the first thing I was going to comment on was you know, we just talked about the extras, but just how many people are in the film in terms of the background, right from the start. And you get those street scenes right at the start. And it's such a busy film almost from the opening.
Yeah, and what I will say, I found this film, it's a film of three parts for me.
Yes, yeah.
Because the first third of it's very much style over substance. It looks wonderful, and as you say, all those extras and things like that, but there's no real story to it for a long
Well,
time.
in fact, I did jot down at one point that there's a lot of later films that follow the kind of same sort of narrative, things like Full Metal Jacket.
Yeah.
We get that the early bit of the film is about our guys that are going to be in the film, and that's it's done quite quickly. They're basically all at school,
Yeah.
and we get that speech from their teacher, and then of course then we get the again really brief section about them in training.
Yeah.
More modern films can go on for quite a bit, things like Full Metal Jacket and all those other ones. And then the third part, the biggest portion of the film, is the war.
Yeah.
But weirdly, with that segment where he goes back home for a little while, so it's
Yeah,
kind of like
which for
three and
me
a
is
half
the,
parts almost.
Yeah, that's kind of that first portion, as you mentioned, would be my first third. Then the wall bit in the middle is kind of like the second portion. And then him going home is kind of the third portion. And I know we get a little bit more after that, but it does feel like those are the three different parts. As I say, that first part doesn't really give us much. We
No.
don't even know the characters' names for
No.
a large portion of the first bit. And it's not until he meets or he moves on, because obviously that first bit with the sergeant that they all knew,
Oh, the postman, yeah.
being an ass.
Yeah, he's a complete dick. I don't need to.
That first part is more about him than the characters we're going to live with throughout the film. And it's not until he moves on and they get the new people and they join forces with other
Yeah,
ranks.
we get the talk. They're quite fun. The boys that have already been in the war, the veteran guys that have been there
Yeah,
for
and that's kind
a
of
while.
when the film kicks off for me.
I can't remember what his name was off the top of my head. The guy who was out searching for food,
Yeah.
Krasinski or something like that. I think
Yeah.
his name was remember writing. I thought for me he was one of the highlights of that bunch of other guys.
Yeah.
He's the sort of guy that. And I want to say this without actually seeing the remake that something like Ernest Borgnine would have played in later years.
Yeah.
Because there is a 1979 version, which I need to track down and watch. And you could just imagine that he's probably in that and I don't need to know or something like that. But that's the sort of,
Yeah.
is that sort of character that Ernest Borgnine kind of character. And then you've got the other guy, the sort of longer face, the slightly more dim-witted guy. And they're great, actually. They sort of represent the shit that's already been happening in the war, because these guys have gone there quite early, the young
Yeah.
ones. So, but those guys must have been there right almost from the start.
Yeah.
And the fact that they got no food and he's out looking for food all the time.
Yeah, and then there's that scene as well where they're like, the bits of paper mean nothing to us. What else have you got?
In terms of what can you trade?
Yeah.
Because money doesn't mean anything to
Yeah.
them. There's just something else I want to pick out once the battle scenes kick in. The effects element of the film, the bombing stuff is fantastic considering it's
Yeah.
1930.
Yeah,
It
and it.
looks and sounds, given it's a mono film, incredible. It was actually shaking myself off.
Yeah, and I was going to say that. As I said, the first portion of the film does feel like a little bit style over substance. And I would include that because it's so much more than what you would expect from a film. We've watched so many from this period now, including war films, that are nowhere near as good as this one in terms of their effects. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing over the style thing, but it does kind of fit in with that, despite at that point the film seems to be ticking on and telling a story by this point, whereas it wasn't in the first third.
It almost feels it feels like almost like the first blockbuster in some ways, and then in other moments it's a character piece.
Yeah.
But because I mean, because this would have been just on the excuse the pun, on the tails of Wings, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
So we'd already done one First World War film at that point, which you
Yep.
want it. And again, that's a very different sort of film to this.
Yeah, and that's what I mean about it. Just it feels different.
Going back to the postman a minute, and I just love how of course the last bit of the training is when they sort of wrap him up and throw him in the mud. And I thought, ooh, that's not going to go down well later on.
No, there's some very interesting scenes in that early bit. At one stage, someone's getting spanked, which just it feels really left field in this film. Like maybe it'd fit in another film, but it just seemed very strange to be in a war movie.
But yes, like you say, the core of the film really kicks off once they get out to the front, and you see the shit they deal with on a daily basis. Like the lack of food, the mud everywhere, the rats. Oh, there's a I'd written down rats in big letters. There's that horrible scene when they come bursting through,
Yeah.
I actually expect them to start cooking them at one point.
Yeah.
Fairly.
The other thing I want to pick up that he does a good job, and we've talked about this across multiple war movies, all the way from these early ones, all the way through until the more recent war films that we've dealt with. Most films deal with PTSD at the end.
Yeah, this does it during, doesn't it? Yeah, during. Yeah.
Which
Yeah.
really shocked me. There's some scenes that the scene when they're kind of cleaning up. And they all seem to have lost the plot.
Yeah. Yeah, well, we've had several of them. I mentioned the bombing again. That there's a sequence when they're being bombed where one or two are losing their shit. There's some stuff out when they're actually out on the front. The postie later on himself. That's quite shocking when you see what an actual coward he is when he push comes to shove. And he just loses it. And even our hero himself, of course, at one point when he's towards the back end of the film. It's the bit, I think it's in all three versions, the bit where he kills the Frenchman in the hole. And he just sort of loses it at one point, doesn't he? Completely.
In fact, he has a few moments. He has the
Yeah.
moment in the hospital when he thinks they're taking him away to die.
Yes. Yeah.
And also once he's back home as well, he has some moments where it's like, oh, is this how it's going to end? And
Yeah.
it ends actually worse,
Yeah. Yeah. And
than that, unfortunately.
so there's a kind of controlled losing it when he goes back to the school in the back end of the film as well. And basically all the kids there are calling him cowards, and none of them have seen what he's actually got to go through. And yeah, like you say, it is something that you see right from the get, what's at the get go, but as the film goes through, you're seeing the instant reaction basically, as opposed to what you get in some other war films. For instance, The Hurt Locker kind of dealt with it after he'd experienced it, didn't it? So.
And that was kind of where I was pointing towards that. It's strange to tell that story. The only time I think we have seen it is in the one with Charlie Sheen, and the name's gone.
Platoon, yeah.
We see a little bit of it during that, but not really. Until the end,
Yeah.
name was just
Yeah, I
escaping
mean,
me there.
in that film, they very much these things like they use drugs, don't they? And some of them sort of push that to the background a little bit. And whereas in this, it's just raw, intense, in the now, sort of losing their shit, basically. And it's quite disturbing to see as well, to see the sort of clean cut guys suddenly just curled up in a corner, shaking and rocking backwards and forwards.
And it's interesting because it's not until that middle portion of the film that I really care about anybody. Because we have that early scene when the guy loses his leg. And at that point, I didn't really care because I didn't know them. It seems quite early to have done that. And it's not kind of until after that when you kind of learn how it's affected each one of them. And there's that sequence of him taking his boots and passing them on every time someone died.
Yes, I did write it down. I thought that was a very clever device, actually. I thought that was quite nicely
And
done.
that's when I started to care, because you'd kind of understand why each person took them on, because it wasn't the same reason every time.
No, it's just really well shot as well. I think it's like three of them that get caught, that led them on. And it's all just on close-ups of the shoes to start of the boots. I thought it was brilliantly done. I did laugh here. This is basically have a go at all the anti-woke brigade. There's that quite lengthy discussion on war in the middle of the film, and I written ironically so woke because these things go on in films. They have for a decade. It's not a new thing. People discussing the subject matter right front and center. It's been there since the dawn of time. Discussing what the film about isn't a new thing. Yet some people would have you believe it is. And I'd happily say this is a woke film because, in that respect, because it is, because it's about the ridiculousness and the tragedy of war.
And at this point, I will say, To start with, I knew nothing about this film going into it, other than that it was a war movie. I try and avoid, like, as you say, we look at IMDb and Wikipedia, and I avoid it before I start watching a film if I know nothing about it. For a lot of this film, I didn't know it was about the German side of the war.
Oh, interesting. Yeah,
Because
no,
it doesn't really point it out, other than the fact
no.
that you look at the uniforms and you can tell that they're German. But for a
Yeah,
long time,
and
they don't talk about the fact that they're German.
no, you get a few mentions of the fatherland, and just if you get the street signs and stuff like that. But and I think because he was shot in America, of course, and it's an American production, that sort of eases you in a little bit, doesn't it? And in some ways, that's a good thing because it's just about boys going to war, basically,
Yeah, exactly.
and the ridiculousness of that situation, and the tragedy of it as well. And I think that's for me that's quite an interesting way to do it as well. And I suppose I should bring up the remake at this point whilst it's in my head. I've seen the remake, and again, that is a really powerful version as well. Highly recommended to anybody who hasn't seen it. Play slightly differently with some of the narrative hit points, it's the same core message about the stupidity and tragedy of war. Just all in color and a lot more visceral and a lot louder. Again, I'd recommend it in its own right after what if anybody's seen this one. But that's the crux of it. It has got the whole point of the film is stuff that the people would annoyingly call woke. It's a film about other people having to sort of lose their lives because of other people's stupid decision making, basically. There is something I want on that, and now I wanted to pick up. I can't remember what the hell it was. The other thing was the fact we don't see any women for ages, and then all of a sudden we get three front and center.
And
About halfway
it,
through.
again, that's kind of where the film takes its third turn, because it becomes a
Women don't
lighter
look
film at
serious.
that point. It's very
Yeah.
strange.
Yeah. Because it was very strange because it's just suddenly, and then basically, the guy on the bridge, the officer or the guard tells them they're not allowed to get out of the river on that side. And never quite understood why, because they're obviously all behind their own lines. I go, well, it can't be enemy lines, surely. It's never really completely explained, but then they ignore it anyway. I thought that was a nice sequence there, where the four of them are fighting over three women, and they stitch up the older bloke.
Who was the one that kind of discovered them?
Yeah, and got the meat and the booze at the bottom of the river, and they sort of stitch him up. They were quite interesting that those three French ladies, because they were of course they were all speaking native without any subtitles as well or anything, so it was just a little bit more realism to it.
And it also meant we learned a little bit more about the core characters as well.
Yes, we did.
Mainly because they were freer, and it kind of showed their personalities a little bit more, because obviously during the war it's all very tough and things like that. But then you get to learn a little bit more about them as people during those scenes as well.
There's another moment in that portion of the film as well, with all the coffins. Then all of a sudden they're being blown up because there's another bloody bombing target. That's it. There's and alongside that there's a bit in the back end of the film, the churchyard, which is quite brutal. And that was quite disturbing as well. So there's some quite uncomfortable segments throughout the film, really. More so, particularly in the back end. And that graveyard segment is one that springs to mind. You see him sort of scurrying for cover amongst blown up graves and crosses and gravestones and stuff like
Yeah,
that.
it's definitely at times it's a tough watch.
One of the most disturbing things I've written down here was. He gets a kiss on the lips from his mother.
That's
Very
all
bohemian.
very, it's all very strange as well. It's another one of those ones where it seems like his mother spent the whole entire war in bed. And that's not the first time we've seen that. And then all of a sudden, miraculously, she can get out of bed once he's at home.
The only bit that didn't really work for me is that it's a scene because when he went back home, is the bit with the old men all discussing how that they should move forward with the war. And I think it's only there really to sort of serve a purpose for Paul that he doesn't want to be there, that he'd rather be on the front, and that's the quite sad thing about it. He feels more alive in the war than he does at home.
Yeah, and I think that's the case for a lot of people, isn't it?
Well, again,
Again, the
it's a
Hurt
scene he shares
Locker,
with the Hurt Locker. Yes.
yeah, is that he tries to come home and it doesn't work for him and he has to go back.
Yes, and I guess it's another element in some ways of PTSD for some soldiers.
Some people, I guess it's the same thing, I suppose, if you move away for some people and you stay there and then someone tells you you've got to go back to where you came from.
And they want to go because they've gotten used to that new life and that new lifestyle and that new personage. And I think that's kind of what makes his demise at the end, all that more sad, is that he's found a quiet place again as well in that last couple of moments of the film. And then he spots the butterfly, and you're watching that thing. Oh, please don't stick your head above the parapet. And interesting, I didn't mention it in the facts, but apparently that's not his hand. It's the director's, because it was shot a bit later on. So the director had to do a pickup shot for that, where you see the hand go limp.
And that's another interesting take because the Civil War that's come out recently with Kirsten Dunst, she's been doing quite a lot of interviews, and interestingly, she said the same thing about the final shot in the Virgin Suicides. It's not her. She'd
It's
already
a different shot.
left to film something else, and it's the director's hand.
So it's a commonality, obviously, when they're going to do a close up and nobody else about. I'll just stick my own hand in front of the camera. Job done. I can't. I said I mentioned the coffins are. The leg losing it is quite an uncomfortable scene. Is there any other moments for you that really stood out that you wanted to just mention?
Not really, as you say. I think a lot of the kind of the one for me is when he, the older guy, gets caught by the stray bomb, and he thinks he's
Oh,
still
yes.
alive. But he's
Yes, yes, yes,
carrying
yes.
him back, and he thinks he's going to get him to the hospital, and everything's going to be okay. And
And the thing
unfortunately,
is,
he's already dead.
the blast wasn't right next to me either. It was quite a little bit away, wasn't it? But it's enough to finish him off. And you don't realize for a moment, and until they sort of pull back with the camera a little bit, and you can see that he's just lying there limp. And then the fact that he takes him back, and then the two guys in the hospital tent just they process his name, and then they carry on playing cards. And again, that just shows the brutality and the mundaneness for everybody that was involved, that it becomes day to day, that sort of stuff.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, that was the one standout scene that was quite hard hitting for me. Was that sequence?
Well, after everything they've gone through together.
Yeah.
Well, I suppose at that point, we sort of give our sort of final thoughts, final score, anything you want to say?
No, it was a strange one, I would say, because it started off and I thought, oh, this really isn't what I thought it was going to be. As I said, it very much felt like they'd put a lot of effort into to making it look good and not really worrying about what was going on story wise. It wasn't until that middle portion that we kind of got to know the lead characters. In general, it felt like it lacked that at the beginning. But as you say, that the middle portion did kind of mesh those two bits together. It looked great. As you say, the special effects were fantastic. For a film that's nearly 100 years old, it really held up. And compared to even some of the later ones that we've watched, I think it's felt better. And then the end portion kind of
with a
is,
big camera.
yeah, exactly. And then the end portion kind of does an about face and does what the first portion didn't do. But kind of loses that kind of big epic filmness that the middle portion has had, and becomes very melancholy at the end. And it's a very well put together film because it completely distracts you from what that opening sequence felt like. So yeah, for me, I'm gonna give it an 80 because we've talked about this before. Sometimes we won't watch these films all in one sitting.
No.
Yeah, this one I did. So
Yeah. Yeah,
it's
like
obviously there's something to it.
because
And yeah,
2.25 hours roughly, and I missed,
yeah.
you know, all yet. Oh, it's yesterday, Saturday afternoon, no football, and
Yeah, I watched it. Yeah, I watched it yesterday afternoon as well.
So I mean, for me, I think it was a really, it's an interesting film. Like you say, it's an early model for the way a lot of these war films go, where the young guy goes off to war, the home bit. Even things like Tom Cruise film, Born on the 4th of July, stuff like that. They all have the home life bit, then the training segment, then the core of the film is the experience. And this is definitely feels like the blueprint for a lot of those other films in later years that have done that. So that's a credit in its favor as well. The acting, I think it's really honest and really giving it their all. And as the film goes on, you do care about these guys and what happens to them. Like we've mentioned, the visuals and the in-camera effects are incredible for that era. And I'll probably myself would give this maybe an 83. So yes, we're not far out in the sort of scores.
Definitely.
And I say, and I would recommend him for yourself to check out the version on Netflix for a straight comparison. And I think, and the TV movie from the 70s is also on YouTube, I believe. So both the other versions are available for people to watch. I suppose at that point now we should just have a look at what we're going to do for the next two.
Yeah. So as always, I've pre-prepped. Tony has no idea. We like to get him guessing. So the first one is 1968.
What's he, Sydney Poitier, in Heat of the Night?
Yep, it is.
Oh, yeah.
And then the second one, we're dropping 30 years further into the past to 1938.
And that would be, I'm trying to think what we haven't done at that top end or back end. What's the one with Clark Gable? I can't think of what it's called.
The Life of Emile Zola.
Oh, no, it's not that. It's Emile Zola. I wouldn't have got it
Yeah.
anyway. Life of Emile Zola. Oh, cool. Two very different films, I suspect.
Yeah, which we like. We like them to pull out some interesting ones. And we were just saying we've got, in fact, by that point, yeah, we've got about a year's worth of films left. So we've pushed through. It'll be about 4 years worth of podcasts by the time we finished.
One of my Facebook memories popped up the other day. It was one of the films we were looking at. I think, was that 2 years ago?
Yeah, amazing to think
Crazy.
that.
All right. Cool. Right. Well, I suppose that just leaves you for me to say thank you, mate.
No worries. Thoroughly
And
enjoyable as always.
thank you to everybody listening. And we will see you all again next month.